Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
Y'all, I'm so stoked for our guest today because I'm a huge fan. Our guest is director Larry Fessenden. He has directed and written films such as Depraved, Habit, Wendigo, and he's the founder of Glass Eye Picks. He is a big fixture in the horror film scene, not just in New York City, but worldwide. And his latest film, Blackout, is out now. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Well, hey, guys. This is awfully fun. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're so excited to have you to chat about your film and movies in general. I'm so excited. But first, let's talk about Blackout. Can you give our listeners a little bit of information about the film in case they're not familiar with it yet?
Yeah, so I make it very clear it's a werewolf movie. I don't hide that. It's even on the poster. You can see the design. And the idea was that, what else are we offering if it's not going to be, you know, the reveal of the monster? It's a more psychological story. It's about a fine arts painter who lives in upstate New York, and he's definitely got some serious issues, and he's trying to resolve them with a kind of urgency that leads you to understand this is his maybe last day on Earth. And so he goes to his friend Earl and asks Earl to dispatch him with a silver bullet. And, you know, it's really a story of a man trying to come to terms with his life and set his house in order, and things spiral out of control. His mission doesn't quite come true. And so it's a series of encounters with local townspeople, and it's a portrait of a small town in America, contemporary, and with the wonderful werewolf vibe haunting the whole picture. And that's what it is. It's a character study with some teeth.
Hell yeah. Well, I've always loved Habit and Depraved, and how you take those like classic monsters that we're used to seeing and putting them in a different context. And so I was wondering why werewolves now, like why you wanted to tackle a werewolf and a werewolf story here now.
Well, come on. Werewolf is the coolest. Probably the one I wanted to be. As a kid, I probably wanted to be a werewolf. I can tell you that's what I wanted. And then, I loved Frankenstein for his pathos, but you didn't want to be Frankenstein. He felt like horribly misunderstood. Whereas a werewolf, there was a little sense of revenge in there. You could go get back at all your enemies and some of your friends who were frenemies. Anyway, I just also the idea of just running wild through the woods and, you know, being a little closer to nature, all of that appealed to me. So I eventually had to make a werewolf movie. I have tried for many years.
Oh.
I was very turned on by a comic book from the 70s called Werewolf by Night. I know Disney did just put out a little 1 hour something or other. I wouldn't say that represented at all what I loved about the comic. So I ask you to reconsider the comic book itself. But I tried to do that with Miramax, believe it or not, in the 80s or maybe it was the 90s. And as with all my work, I ended up having to do it my way on a small budget, which was very, very happy place. Making tactile films is what is my jam in the end. So, yeah, it gets to join Depraved and Habit as one of my sort of universal movies, reboot or I don't know what, re-examination.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. So
there's two things. One, it's so funny that we're talking about Blackout because we just recorded with the author Stephen Graham Jones, and he also wanted to, we talked about The Howling for him, but he also wanted to be a werewolf growing up. And so I just, it's so funny because like I also as a kid wanted to be a werewolf. I think Mary Beth, you had said that you
I did want to be a werewolf when I was a child. I scared people. My grandma came up to me and said, my friend's daughter is scared of you now because apparently you want to be a werewolf and you're acting like one in the cafeteria at school. And like, she doesn't want to be your friend anymore. And I was like,
yeah,
that was me as a kid.
Yeah, I got stories like that. Well, people still call me Scary Larry. But it's funny.
The The rhyming is too good.
Well, the rhyming, it makes it so easy. You know, I never wanted to be a vampire. That never seemed interesting at all. So it is about the visceral animal nature of the werewolf, I'd say.
Yeah. But then also, I'm curious because we talked about, you brought up Depraved and we talked about Habit. Are there any other of those kind of like monster movies that you would want to tackle in the future?
Not that I think I would have access to, you know, given my profile as a filmmaker. I just don't think I could get the money together to make Creature from the Black Lagoon. But that's the other monster that I love. Another beautiful design, just like, and the only thing weird about that is you'd really have to make that with Universal because I don't think the design could be improved on. You know, Guillermo del Toro, well, I don't want to say he tried, he succeeded in his way to make a beautiful fish creature, but that still doesn't reach the heights of the Gillman. There's a lot I could talk about. You know, why the Gillman is just a perfect, beautiful, you know, male icon of just awesomeness. And he's got the rubber abs and the sort of the, just all of it. This is just beautiful. And I love that it was technically designed by a woman. We don't know that for sure, but I mean, we know that, but I don't know what amount of detail, but Millicent, who actually has a cameo in Blackout. There's a fish company on the side of a van and it's called Millicent's Fisheries or something. we're attributing her there. That's the first time I've ever revealed that. I didn't even remember that until I was talking. That'll be in the commentary if I ever get to that.
That's so cool. Are there any other cool Easter eggs like that sprinkled out throughout Blackout?
Well, actually, Blackout has a lot of Easter eggs because it is calling back to
Talbot Falls too. Yeah.
Talbot Falls, of course, but you know, there are other things. You know, I have an immigrant community that they're sort of Mexicans or whatever, but they're kind of playing as the gypsies play in the original, which is to say, you know, ooh, the outsiders. So I'm riffing on, you know, on both the archetypes and also saying let's look at this again with fresh eyes and so on. And the funny thing is, they all work in this small town as like gardeners and what have you. So he says at one point, yeah, you think, you know. The werewolf says, you be careful what you say or there's going to be, you know, a mob coming after you with pitchforks. And he says, yeah, we know about pitchforks. We know how to use pitchforks. So whatever, I'm playing games with that. There's other,
hell yeah,
those kind of Easter eggs and what have you.
Cool. That's awesome. So I'm curious though, Larry, like, how did you get into horror movies? When did that start for you? What age?
As little as I was. You know, this is true. And I don't know if it's true because it's a mother's tale. But my mother says my first word was monster. Can you imagine? How would I know that word? It's hard to believe it's true, but I sort of cherish the idea. I always loved dinosaurs and sharks. Ironically, all these things have become mainstream since I grew up. Remember, I grew up in the 70s. So there was one movie called Blue Water White Death about great white sharks, and it blew my mind. And then I was the first to read Jaws and waited patiently for the movie. But I also loved dinosaurs. I wrote books on dinosaurs, and so Jurassic Park was my jam. I grew up loving Godzilla and all that vibe, and then I loved the Universal movies. It's historically true that, you know, they sold all these movies in the 50s to TV, and then that generation of kids loved the monsters. Then they started making serials and models and Famous Monsters of Filmland led to Fangoria, but Famous Monsters was even earlier. Anyway, this is the long story. I'm really just a cliche of my age, to be honest. But my first movie was King Kong. I saw it.
Oh.
And I couldn't believe what I was watching, and I love that monster. It's not obviously, it didn't, I didn't have it as my choice for this because it didn't scar me, but it made a lasting impression. I loved that film and couldn't quite tell what I was looking at. And my first movies were animated for that matter. So,
wait, so Godzilla, what were your favorite Godzilla movies growing up? Do you remember?
Well, I loved the three-headed Ghidra. He was the meanest one, but I was always tickled by the turtle, which is, I guess, Gamera.
I love the turtle.
So I love them all. You know, even when I was little, I was like, I could tell the tonal things were all over the place. And, you know, you'll notice from my actual movies that I take all this very seriously. So I didn't so much love the goofy stuff when Godzilla would get up and dance or whatever.
Okay.
And so in a weird way, I would argue that even the new stuff, I like the reboot, the first one, which not everybody liked. They said not enough Godzilla. I don't know. But I thought it was very reverent. Garth Edwards. So
yeah.
I did like that one. And then even though he's my pal making the new ones, they're getting also goofy in some other way. I don't like the Monarch storyline with the whole idea of a wonderful secret society of nations that get along.
Hollow Earth.
Yeah, I don't like Hollow Earth. It's too much like another kind of genre. It's more sci-fi.
Yeah.
To me, the Godzilla is about a giant monster in our midst. It's like an environmental parable. It's whatever. Anyway, or a war parable. I love. All right, we just leave it at this. Godzilla Minus One, favorite movie of the year.
So good.
Yes, so fucking good. Did you see Shin Godzilla? I'm sorry. No, I'm a huge Godzilla freak. That's why I'm asking.
It's so wonderful you ask. You know, I was so aware of it that I bought it and I have never watched it. And now I know it's a treasure to behold because of. I think it has more in common with Godzilla Minus One than the new American.
It does.
One. Yeah,
it 100% does. If you like scary, you have to watch Shin Godzilla. Yeah. I promise you will dig it. Anyway,
cannot wait to get done with this freaking blackout tour so I can go home and watch movies.
You're like, I just want to watch movies in a cave and not talk to anyone forever for the rest.
Exactly. So so thank you.
I cannot wait for you to watch that one.
I can't wait either. That's wonderful. But, you know, anyway, I don't mind the CGI for our giant creatures. I'm very happy with the Jurassic Park movies and, you know, except for, as I say, tonal things. But I love just seeing all these monsters come alive. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So what I love is when people talk about Universal Monsters as being sort of like an introduction to it, and as well as like the movies from that time period, like King Kong, because that's how I got introduced. My dad, I think what you were saying really clicked with me, because my dad, who grew up in like the 50s, and that's when, as you were saying, that they were being licensed to TV and that kind of stuff. Like, I think that is sort of where he got his love of the genre. And so my introduction to the genre had always been the Universal Monsters or the Hammer films of the 60s and King Kong. So I always love it when that is the entry point for our guests.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, you know, the nice thing is that at the time you were invited to participate. In other words, they had the monster models, which were really seminal. And then the paintings of the models was a whole thing, and you can really enjoy online how that developed. I mean, was it Bauma, whatever his name was, and you know, Basil Gogos did all the paintings for the covers of famous monsters. So I mean, there are books about how this was a generational thing. So basically it was capitalism working its magic on a bunch of kids, and you know, the result is a lot of twisted people. I mean, John Landis, I think, would fall into this camp. He's obviously older than us, but he, you know, that was his inspiration. He wrote to Famous Monsters of Filmland. Actually, maybe it's the other guy, but whoever. No, it's Landis. The point is there, and even Spielberg. I mean, a lot of those guys still reference some of these. They did a lot better with this influence, by the way, than I have, but nevertheless. We've all done our thing with this monster love.
Hell yeah. So when you said your first movie was, your horror movie was King Kong, do you remember how old you were when you saw it?
I mean, maybe 7. I remember I was in a hotel. Cool. I don't know what was going on. So I was just watching TV while they did some other thing in the other room. And there it was. It was just so cool.
Did that like inspire you to seek out more horror movies as a kid?
I don't think I knew what I was watching. I thought it was a movie about a giant monkey. And then I saw you know, the sequels. Yeah. So I can't really track from the King Kong. I can't really track what happened next, but then I can just say as many weekends as possible spent watching the black and white movies. And, you know, of course there were a lot of worse ones, and there were really cool ones, and The Crawling Eye, and just all this banana stuff, all of which had, you know, that's the thing about it. It's funny because I love cinema, and I'll use the term cinema, and I'll talk about highbrow things, and I love Ingrid Bergman and all that. Well, Ingrid Bergman, yes, but I mean Bergman, the filmmaker. And, you know, and then, of course, I became a Hitchcock lover. But the point is that with horror, it's funny because you like a lot of bad movies because there's one or two images that are resonant, and that's kind of the magic. It's very avant-garde, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and
yeah.
Especially in the old days, these paper mache suits, like even It, The Terror from Beyond Space, which is the precursor to Alien and one of the great movies with this one weird sound effect, you know, and you're like, oh my God. And yet, you know, when the monster shows up, he's like just in a big rubber suit, but it doesn't matter. The atmosphere of that is so chilling and so on. So, you know, you're more forgiving, I think, than a lot of cinephiles who grew up liking good movies. They don't understand the magic, that mysterious sweet sauce of what makes an image haunting and indelible, you know. So that's what I still love that's why I have great fondness for horror fans, because they're involved in something deeper than just like great storytelling. They're looking for that strange intangible essence that's closer to witchcraft than you know, filmmaking.
That's what I was gonna say. Like, horror fans, we're such a weird breed, because like we will champion movies that really aren't technically good, but we're like, but you don't understand, the vibes are perfect. And I think that's what I love about horror, is that we're so, for the most part, we are more forgiving in a way of bad movies, because we understand and appreciate, like you said, the witchcraft of filmmaking and what it means to make a scary movie. And it's awesome. I loved being able, like this bad movie from 1992, and someone's like, I do too. And you can just bond over that. Oh, like, that's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah. And I was just at a horror film festival, The Overlook, which is a fantastic film.
Oh, the best.
Lives in New Orleans now. And, you know, there you have it. These are just wonderful people. I always like to say horror people, you know, they're thinking about death and the fragility of life and just, you know, sudden violent horror. So they really, they're very warm people, because they know that this time on our planet is limited. And so I find them much more, you know, you wouldn't want to go to a comedy festival. Those people are all angry. They're all angry. But you want to have a beer with a horror lover.
Yes.
I mean, I'm biased, but yeah, you do.
Or a couple beers, maybe.
At least one, if not more.
Yeah.
So it sounded like kind of horror has been in your DNA from either the very first word that you spoke to seeing King Kong at an early age. Did you ever get scared watching movies as a kid?
Yeah, I've always been a scaredy cat. The joke in our house was that I would read horror comics all day long, creepy and eerie, and then the precursors, Where Monsters Dwell, all this weird stuff. And then at night I couldn't sleep. I was terrified. And I would go and stand outside my parents' door for like half an hour, because I didn't want to really wake them, but I didn't know where else to go. And then eventually my mother would go, yes, what's going on? And her point was like, all day long you've been reading these comics, what do you expect? So that's actually in one of my films, a film called Wendigo. I have that exact scene. And the kid is just quietly standing outside the door, too afraid to bother the parents. My parents were very nice, but they, you know, they had their limits. You know, they were raising this maniac kid. So, yeah, I was always scared of everything. I thought the shark from Jaws was in my closet. I mean, I couldn't, I there was no logic to it. And also the movie Duel freaked me out. I thought the truck was in the
closet. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I was at a tender age. I'm the youngest of three. Whatever. This was just, the point is my imagination was completely bananas, running wild, and it was always something bleak and stark. So I try to capture that almost naive innocence in my films. And then the only other thing I'll say that might be fun for this is that one night I watched Night of the Living Dead, thinking it was a black and white scary movie, as it was. And then but that movie is different, of course. We all know that now. But as a kid, I was watching it, and I was like, something's weird about this. It's not it's hopeless. It just gets worse and worse, and it's relentless, and everything goes wrong. She doesn't escape at all. She runs the car to the tree, and then she's fucked again. So I could just, I sense there was something else going on. Well, of course, it was made in 1968, not 1938. So it was a new kind of horror, and that's when I realized, ooh, this stuff can get really real and really randy, even though we could argue there are bad effects in that movie, but who cares that the hand looks like it's made of clay? It's the atmosphere. So usually I think atmosphere is more important than, and in a weird way that ends up being my jam, because I don't work with a great deal of money. So I'm putting atmosphere and sort of, I'm inviting the audience to help build the movie with me. You know, maybe the suit doesn't look perfect, but come on guys, work with me here. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, so exactly. That's been my approach. But it comes from this love of, if you will, bad movies. And as I say, I love Hitchcock. I don't think he makes bad movies. But, you know, Hitchcock has another thing going, which is that he's very mannered. So, I love all kinds of movies. That's the point.
Hell yeah. Before we move into your Scarred for Life pick, I do want to know, what is the scariest movie you've seen recently? Do you know? Do you remember? Do you have one?
Well, it's kind of what I'll be talking about. You know, there are different kinds of horror, and you notice that a lot of the things we've talked about are monster movies, but they're not. So in the 80s, when movies became slasher movies, I was disoriented because it's not as fun. It's actually closer to what's awful. You know, I'm the kind of guy that thinks about home invasions. Just like the randomness and the, quite honestly, the untrustworthiness of other people. I just, you know, I find the world alienating and lonely. And so I'm just like very wary of other people. So, you know, it's one of the reasons I will speak about my choice, so to speak, because it takes you to a dark place. But I mean, I thought Talk to Me, the first half hour is fantastic. And you know why? It's one moment before the movie even gets going. There's some kids looking at a phone and they're like, oh man, it's so crazy. What happened to them? And you're like, wait, what is going on? And you see, I mean, it's good filmmaking. You see only very briefly the image on the phone. And I think they've done the one thing they do with the people who are afflicted by the hand. You just see the eyes are dilated.
The eyes. Mm-hmm.
And you're like, you're immediately like, ooh, not good. No. And then you get into the scene and you're like, okay, now I see what's going on. And it's obviously what's going on is scary, but it's the participation of the kids with their phones. I mean, maybe it's because I'm older and I find like this is what's going wrong with the world, is like we're filming each other going through terrible trauma. So I really thought the beginning of that was amazing, up to the kid getting his face smashed in. And then it's a good movie, and you know, I'm happy to have a movie like that be successful. But it's really the beginning, which is, I could actually say the same with The Exorcist for me. So in a weird way, it's often the setup where it's scary. You know why? Because you don't know what's going on. And then once they have to explain it, and it's funny when you get notes on the script and they're like, well, you have to explain what's happening. You're like, well, that's when the movie always goes south. So actually, no, how about we don't? Anyway,
that's the hardest thing. I feel like there's so much of a need to over explain nowadays, which I know we don't want to get too into it. You have probably plenty of experience, Larry, with people being like, over explain exactly why this is scary. And you're like, well, like you said, it's not scary anymore. So
it's really interesting, the dynamic. Like, you're going to remake Halloween by showing that he had a traumatic childhood. Well, then he's no longer the boogeyman. He's a guy who had a bad time. Yeah. And then you're like, oh, well, no wonder he's a murderer. That's sad. But of course, once again, that's a segue into our topic.
I was going to say, that's a great segue into our topic.
Yeah. Right, listen, this isn't my first barbecue.
It was like, Larry's hosting this. He's like, I know how to host a podcast.
guys, if you could just keep it down, because I got it.
I know how to do a transition, okay?
That's right, exactly.
Great segue.
That's right. Speaking of blackout, how about those transitions?
Okay, well, Larry, what movie did you bring with you today for us to be talking about?
Okay, I brought Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
All right. So excited. For anyone who is unfamiliar with this film, please watch it if you haven't yet. One and two, arriving in Chicago, Henry, based on actual serial killer Henry Lee Lucas, moves in with ex-con acquaintance Otis and starts schooling him in the ways of the serial killer.
Boy, okay, this movie is gnarly. But I gotta know, Larry, take us back. How old were you when you saw this movie? How did you see it? What about it scared you? Why is this your Scarred for Life pick?
Well, I was the age when it came out in theaters. And as you maybe know, it has a great history. And it's ironic because it's distributed by the company that is distributing Blackout. And I made, eight films with MPI or Dark Sky. That's the same company. So apparently long ago in the 80s, they hired this dude, John McNaughton, to make a scary movie because they realized there might be some money in that. And he made Henry, and they watched it, and they were like, whoa, no. And they literally put it on the shelf, and it lived there for a period of time, years. And then the errand boy, and he does have a name. There's a story attached to it. I'm sure it's on Wikipedia or whatever it's called. He plucked it off, and he said, guys, I think we should give this a shot. It's really good. It's an art film, but it's really good. They called it an art film. They put it out, and it's now a classic, and it's out. It's been 30 years. So then that means if it's really 30 years, then I was, 30. So it isn't like something scarred me as a kid. I had to I've already revealed in this interview, I was scarred by so many movies as a kid, but I wanted to come up with the thing that I think still holds up as scarring.
Sure does.
It's really, really intense. And it also is kind of exemplifies what I do think my brand of horror, which is I've never made a movie this chilling and this horrifying, but it's the same idea of let's really do something psychologically real. Because, Freddy Krueger kills a lot of people, and those are very those are fun, artful movies, obviously, especially because of the dreamscape. But you're never going, you don't need to take a shower. Whereas after Henry, you just might want to. It's so bleak and it's so well drawn. And you really feel for these people, and yet you don't ever want to meet them. It is also an interesting, there's a lot of subtle things happening. It's like a class discovery. These are people who ended up in prison. And then they get out, and they'll never recover from that. And also, more importantly, they have terrible childhoods. So it's weird because I just made fun of the Rob Zombie approach to Halloween. You that guy's no longer a boogeyman. He's actually a guy with a sad past. But when you do it in Henry, it's the DNA of the film. You're basically it's a character study of a guy who is a serial killer. I mean, it's a step-by-step portrait. And it's funny that the synopsis says it's about corrupting Otis, which I don't know what I would have said the movie was, but I guess that is the plot. And it was really on second viewing or whatever, on a reviewing, I realized, that is what it is. He was not inclined that way. By the way, little known fact, Otis is the name of my character in a film I made called Wendigo, and that's a tribute to this Otis. So it did make an impression, and it was something that I was happy to champion, even though I recoil from it. I have a little teeny list of movies that are really effective that I don't ever want to watch again, but I own them all because I think they stand as a in their own little section. And another one is Man Bites Dog. Another one is Angst, one of my favorite movies.
Oh. Yes.
Another one is, Irreversible has sort of, these are movies that are so disturbing. And then weirdly, I think Them, which is then called The Strangers. So you notice the commonality is it's when it's just about humans murdering people. I actually don't want to live in those worlds. And as I get older, I think it's less my jam. But if you're going to do it right. The blood in Henry is so good. I mean, that sounds goofy, but, blood in horror movies is often not good. It's often too viscous. It's often, looks gelatinous.
Yeah.
you know, ironically, Martin Scorsese can do blood. You know, there's some, and I guess Tarantino, there are people who know how to do it. But most of the 80s horror movies that have gore scenes, you know, it all feels a little phony, but maybe in a fun way. Maybe that's the point of it. You know, Friday the 13th or something, that's good. It's a different vibe, and that's fine. I'm not opposed to it. It's not my jam entirely. Henry is so awful that I think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you saw this when it first came out. Did it play in theaters at all? Did you see it in a theater, or how did you watch it?
I think I saw it in New York. I might be correct saying I saw it at Angelica. The only funny thing is I might be crossing my wires with them. That's where I saw what's the witch movie that was Blair Witch. But whatever. The point is, you know, horror was finding itself during that period, or revising itself. Of course, it's always been around. And, you know, I didn't choose Texas Chainsaw Massacre, another absolute masterpiece of filmmaking, and somehow more warm than Henry, because I guess it's just a little more fanciful, the editing, but also the chainsaws. And it's so gothic. It's almost insane. Chainsaw. I took a girl to that. I thought we were going to have a long future together. That was kind of it for us. Anyway, that's a great movie. So we can talk about violence in cinema, but Henry is just so unbearably bleak, and the performances are so striking. And, you know, there's a lot of really subtle things, which I just, you know, it is about sexuality and repression as well. And obviously Henry, the character, has been ruined by his terrible mother. The things that she has done to him is why he's a serial killer. I mean, if you're going to follow a narrative. And then Otis has got some terrible problems. He's drug dealing with this young like football star. And there's a moment when Otis puts his hand on the kid, on his thigh, you know, and you just realize, oh, fuck, Otis has got his own fucking hell. And of course he gets, you know, punched in the face, and then he becomes more murderous. So it is Henry's influence, but it's Otis discovering that he also has repressed, you know, inability to express his desires. So then you just realize, oh, this is so awful. All these people are just like, they can't control their their sadness and their, and then, you know, the girl basically knows these people are murderers, and yet she manages to fall in love with Henry. So it's a beautiful portrait of these very lost people on the perimeter of society. And Henry makes it clear. He says, you can't kill that football guy because we'll get found out. So then you realize it's about class. That's what I mean. He just kills people on the periphery. And the one person he doesn't kill, he follows this woman, and then her husband comes out and there's a little kiss, and you're almost like she's protected by the traditions of society. You know, she's just that little bit of a class above some of the other. A lot of the victims they're all very unlucky. And talk about scarring. I'm sorry, I'm going to shut up in a second. But,
no, I love it.
Please.
As far as scarring, the other thing in that movie is the one long take where they kill the family. So not only are they killing this woman, and you're like, ugh, first of all, it's just so terrible, especially seeing with eyes from today, the violence against women from this period. I mean, it's not like I'm blaming the filmmaking. I'm just saying this is the world that we were in and we are in. Anyway, so she's being traumatized, obviously, and then but they're videoing it. That was another thing. It was a little ahead of its time in terms of showing the idea of like videoing your crimes. And then they pan over and the fucking husband's already got a sack on his head and bloody head. Yep. And you're like, oh God, as if that is enough. Then the little kid walks in and he's like, oh no, I think I'm actually not going to come home right now. And then whoop, he's done. That is just an awful scene. And then the dudes are watching it and they're watching it on replay and then slow-mo.
Like entertainment.
So I feel the movie is very prescient, or, you know, I think it's very, it's a rage. It's a cry of rage about, you know, our society in all the right ways. And then, you know, it ends on a very melancholy note. We don't have to completely spoil it, but, you know, the only people you have entree to, don't fare well either. It's just absolutely it's bleak.
It's very bleak. And I, you know, I saw for the first time, I think it was during one of the early revivals of Joe Bob's specials. I think that was my first time watching it. So I saw it then and I was like, this movie grosses me out. And I wasn't sure how to like process it. And so I was really curious to rewatch it for the podcast. And boy, this movie, you mentioned that you might need to take a shower after you're done watching it. I was like, I need to. It's grimy. And what I think works really well for this is it does not allow you to look away. And it does, it kind of, I wouldn't say revels in it, but it also sort of does revel in some of the horrificness and forces you to watch it. There's the one shot of one of the earlier women who is tied to a sink and she has like a bottle shoved in her face. I'm just like, and it lingers on that shot. And I know that shot was like subject of censorship in terms of it like traveling to the UK and whatnot, but boy, that shot is just like one of those like, okay, this is what you're in for, this is what you're going to experience, and it's rough.
And I draw your attention to the craft, though. This is the reason it was so fun, it was remarkable to revisit. It's an incredibly well-crafted movie, and all those initial corpses are done with camera moves. And they're unrelenting. And you're actually wondering, how is this possible? Like, I even started keeping my eyes open as long as it was on the gal. And there's more than her. There's like two or three other corpses of the same nature. So there's a stillness and a quietness to the filmmaking that's actually really elegant and sort of old school. When you shot in film, you just didn't cover things every which way. You know, you made a choice. And so it's actually a really impressive movie to watch. The choices and the camera moves, it's all carefully done, presumably at a budget, but it's really good filmmaking. And then, which leads to the discomfort, because it doesn't feel like it's hiding things or celebrating things. And I would argue, you know, the thing about, you had inspired me to say something about censorship. I don't think this movie is delighting in anything. It's just uncompromising. And that's why I say there's some anger to it. In other words, you can't show this with this tone. There's no time that's sort of gleefully saying, ooh, look at this. It's just like your basic response is like, oh, because you sort of like Henry. He does seem, he seems very tortured. And when the girl is discussing her father, who was clearly some sort of rapist, you just see Henry, he's having an implosion because he's thinking about his mother. And then you're just like, oh, these people are all so damaged. And then, and then even Otis, who does reach a breaking point and he becomes beyond the pale, it's still, even his demise, you're not celebrating it. You're just going like, oh my God. So I think, you know, the violence is not gleeful ever.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a cliche to say, but like, it really is like watching a train accident that you can't stop. You're just like, you're on this ride and you have to finish it. And it's horrific seeing how everyone is just starting to like fall apart.
Yeah.
One of the things I really did appreciate on this viewing, and you talk about like the filmmaking, the way that the two characters, Otis and Henry, are sort of a perfect foil for each other, because Henry, Michael Rooker, is so handsome and so young in this, and he like internalizes a lot of that that anger that he has on the world, whereas like Otis is a bit more forward in like his problems, where like, you know, he is very sexually aggressive towards his sister. Like he gives you icky vibes just without digging into his soul. But then you have Michael Rooker, who is arguably even worse, because you see all those bodies and you know that he killed them, but he is so present in a form that is more visually pleasing. And I'm using that in quotations, but like, it's that internalized horror versus like the outward. And it's just, I don't know. It's so interesting to see them together and sort of playing off of how horrible can we get, really?
Well, you're absolutely right. As I say, and it was, I guess, in the plot description, but you're very aware that Rooker has his routine. He's very specific about, and what's cool about that is it makes you think, like, so what is a serial killer up to? Like, why, what are they doing? And then I think when the sister comes on to him in the most gracious way, very, very, she's saying, I want to share myself with you or whatever. I'm just trying to say, there's nothing grotesque there, but his response, his lack of his discomfort, you're like, oh man, this guy's so broken. And and so actually he's going, and I think he does go and kill someone just to sort of get that out of his system. And it's sad that in a weird way, he teaches Otis that this is how you can get past your feeling of oppression. For example, when Otis does make a pass at the kid, the young football guy, then literally Michael Rooker says, well, let's go for a drive. Then they pretend to break down, and then they get a good Samaritan comes along who offers to help. And to me, it's very subtle, but that kid is cast to appear gay. So they're just following, you know, and he's just a little effeminate, especially from his time. You'd call him a cliche from his time. Very nice. He's like, what can I do to help? But he's just a little bit effeminate or whatever the word is, you know, fragile. They immediately kill him, and you feel like, yeah, you fucker. You see, you can't handle your own problems, so you're lashing out. And I feel like there's a correlation between the sexual arousal, so to speak, and the violence. So this is what I mean. Naughton has total control over his movie, which makes it maybe a more unpleasant ride.
And I think that's why I watched this movie for the first time also in the Joe Bob special when I had just moved to Chicago. So I was like, oh great, like what a great movie to watch while like I had moved to Chicago. Great, awesome. But what I like so much about this movie is that it makes you empathize, not empathize, but never like take the side of. Exactly. And I think that is what a lot of true crime movies do not get is that balance of like, you don't want to put someone on a pedestal, but you also want to give some kind of emotional core to them. But I think so often these killers then become like weird, perverse heroes. But here, what I love so much is that they never let that happen. This is always like, you never are questioning that these people are bad, but you can still see how the systematic things have led to them becoming this way. Like we were talking about, like they went to prison, and we all know even in 2024, we do not have good systems for people to leave prison and become integrated back into society.
Right.
Parents are terrible. There's no way, like odd jobs to get money. And so like you can empathize with these characters. And I think the way that we start the movie with just the zooming in on a dead body with the screaming in the background, again, sets the expectation of like, this guy's fucked up. This guy is just killing women, people, and dumping them. And instead of reveling in the act of a woman dying, we see the result, which I think is a really, again, it's a budget thing, but also very smart. And a really, like you're saying, Larry, a really good use of the camera to establish, we don't need to show all of these extensive kill sequences to show how scary he is, but showing these tableaus of bodies give you that idea of what is going on. And I think one of my favorite moments on this rewatch is when we see him pick up a hitchhiker with a guitar.
Yeah, exactly.
And he goes, oh, going into the city. And then we go to the apartment where Otis and his sister are talking, and he walks in with the guitar. Mm-hmm. And it's all you need to know. Like, it's just such good, like, talk about like showing, not telling. You know exactly what happened. It telegraphs it so well.
Yeah.
And such a way that, and it's like, oh yeah, here, I just got you a present. It's a guitar. And that guitar then carries throughout the entire movie to the end when she's playing the guitar in the hotel room.
Yeah.
And it's just like all of these visual markers are so smart to make this movie feel like not a documentary, but almost like a documentary about just like two dudes killing people in Chicago and the woman who is just trying, and like she's just trying to survive too. And I think one of my favorite things, which sounds so dark about this movie, is that she dies. And I know that's terrible, but like so often in these movies, we want one person, one woman who can prove the serial killer wrong. And like, she's the one who will say that he's the good guy. No. But like, tragically, she's dumped on the side of the road in a garment bag. And like, it's so fucked up, but it's the only way that movie could have ended to me. And it have been as effective as it is, because it is not like I can save you or like some kind of Bonnie and Clyde thing. It's, he's a fucked up guy who's never going to get better. And there's like nothing we can really do about that. And I think that's what makes it so effective and so hard to watch, is that like, there is no, this is just, the story is really just him in Chicago killing people. There isn't like, I know we talked about Otis and like convincing Otis and corrupting Otis, but like, to me, there isn't really much of a plot other than like killing, like a slice of life, killing people and then moving on. And I think,
yeah, well, it's, that's what makes, yeah. It's actually, I don't know if there was a different title, but the title is great because it just says, listen,
perfect.
This is a portrait. Yeah. I'm not going to give you, like you say, there's no morality tale here. There literally is not. I mean, I can't say what it would be.
Don't kill.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but that's the thing. It's really about, this is what this guy does. And in a way, as you say, oh man, how about, the thing is, you do some things retroactively. Like when he says, we should go to bed now, to the girl, you know, as you say, in some movies that would be like, oh, they're finally going to consummate and they are in a hotel now and they're moving on. You know, this could be sweet, but that's not really what he's saying. And then I don't want to know how he might have done it and so on and so on. And she probably doesn't fit in that bag in one piece. So then you're like, no, the whole thing is just too awful. But as you say, there's no other way to have ended this movie, because anything else would have been false. This dude is utterly addicted to murdering people. The other scene that's kind of charming, because it's the only one that has, well, there's a sort of a playfulness, is when he encounters the woman, or is it maybe a man in drag? I don't know what we're looking at, but the guy with the dog. Mm-hmm. And he's ready to kill someone. Because once again, he's had some problem. I guess it's right after the unsuccessful romance with the girl. So he goes out and he's ready to kill. And then for some reason, that person gets away, which is just, you know, well, it's also a movie about happenstance and fate, just tricks of fate, which is the reason that home invasion movies get to me, because it's so random. And like anything, you hear one or two stories where it really happens and you're like, oh, well, then it could happen. And in that case, I am forever fucked.
Well, you talked about the kind of happenstance to it. And one of the things that I really enjoyed on this rewatch was the very beginning of the movie, where Michael Rooker is in a diner and, you know, he's paying his bill. He's stuffing out a cigarette. He I think he comments on her smile, says that you real nice smile you got there. And he leaves. And then it cuts to you know, a woman dead on the counter. And it's not that woman. It is at a liquor store. But it's like this idea that he went in there, he had his food, he didn't kill her, but he goes over to a liquor store and kills a man and a woman there, and their bodies are just lying there. And it is that kind of shark-like nature of him, where he's just moving through and you don't know, is he going to bite you? Is he going to bite your friend? You don't really know how it's going to end. And I love that is the establishment of this film. And then by the end of it, we get the you, Mary Beth, you mentioned Bonnie and Clyde almost. And there's that moment where she says, I love you. And he's like, I guess I love you too. And it's like, there's a part of you like, ooh, do I want them to be together? And then you know that in reality, that's, he's a lone being. He, you know, he's gonna cut and run, and that is what happens, kind of literally, I guess. But also with the visual storytelling, is that we don't need to see him, you know, cutting her up, because we saw him do it to Otis, so we know what he's capable of. You know that he's gonna efficiently just carve her up and stuff her in that bag. And it's that unsettlingness that they'd already established and then just paid off with the lonely bag left on the side of the road. It's so haunting.
It's a really well-made, really well thought out film. And I love that you're tracking the guitar. That's another example of just like, it's just gracefully peppered in. It doesn't have some deep meaning, but it is, it's just like sort of the objects in life that are haunted by the circumstance. Obviously the whole fetishizing of the silly video camera, and then he breaks it somehow. And you're like, is this like, I feel like in some movies, or worse yet, in a story meeting, they'd say, well, now the police will find the videotape. And you're like, good Lord, who fucking cares? This isn't about that. This is about, it's a portrait. I'm sorry. It's a portrait of a serial killer. In case you didn't know that, please refer to the title. It's not the story of how they caught the guy or any of those things. It's just, relentlessly awful. And you're right, another thing is, remember they have a scene where she's going to get a newspaper, and your mind is like, oh, she's gonna read about a murder, and I don't know, we're gonna go spiraling off into that. No, it's just to show that she's looking for a job, and then that just leads to the fact that she gets a job, which, by the way, she fairly quickly abandons. So okay, that was just that, but it's cool, and it's
Well, and this is based on Henry Lee Lucas, who was a real serial killer. And I think, again, so many true crime things today could take some pointers from Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer in terms of how we are telling stories about these people. Because Henry Lee Lucas is the kind of serial killer that like super terrifies me, because he's a drifter serial killer. So he just goes all over the country. And he also he was terrifying because he said he killed 600 people, but there's only confirmed 13 or 14, which is still a lot. But like, his story is just so bizarre. And again, this movie gets some of it right, because it, but again, you know, it's a movie, so it's, some of it is obviously exaggerated. But with his mom, the way his mom treated him with Otis, like a lot of this is telling the story and a portrait of a real serial killer. Like, this is much, there's the line between fiction and reality here is a little bit more blurred than I think many people might know in terms of like what the story is. Like, this isn't just a Henry, a guy they made up. Like, this is very much a real person who killed a lot of people and traveled around the country committing a lot of really fucked up murders and wasn't caught until he confessed, which I think is also terrifying with a lot of serial killers. Is a lot of them don't get caught until they get bored and like, I want people to pay attention to me now. Like, hi, like, can you pay attention to me now? Because, and apparently he got like the Texas Lone Rangers in a lot of fucking trouble, because he basically fooled everybody with all of his fake confessions. The confession killer. And he, which is wild, but it's just like, him as a serial killer versus him as a character, I think this is one of the rare moments where they do due diligence and not romanticizing and really, again, once again, creating a portrait of a serial killer and like what it means to be one and what that looks like. It's not this like, oh, he's so handsome and cute and oh, everyone loved him. Like, no, he's a fucking creep. And like, he is really gross. Like, and it's just nothing to be kind of wearing t-shirts about and like, declaring your love for online. Like, this is a real guy who killed real people who had families. And then I think it's just such an interesting film to look at with the true crime boom in the last decade. I think.
No, that's a good point. And I actually can't watch true crime, but of course, as you know, in many households, the woman loves the true crime. My wife loves, I mean, she likes detective things like cozies, I guess they're called, but yeah, I take it too seriously. I mean, you know, an interesting precursor to this is In Cold Blood, which also has just this, was made in the 50s or something, just a bleakness, because it was a real crime. Of course, Truman Capote got famous from it. And I remember reading the book. I mean, in the 70s, serial killers were a real thing, and there was Ted Bundy.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously, we were always haunted by Manson and so on. It's weird. We don't have serial killers, but we have school shooters. Thank goodness we have something. Anyway, it's also depressing. And that's, I don't even want to get into that. Because the irony is, none of this is really, I don't actually find my great happiness in this kind of entertainment. But I think when it's done well and respectfully, at least that stands as an example. I think, you know, we're just saying that, you know, if you're going to do it, let's do it right. And this is one example. There's more. And there's also extreme horror like Inside and those kind of movies. As I say, as I get older, I'm just less inclined towards them. But, you know, I certainly have respect for that, as opposed to the Herschel Gordon Lewis thing, which is more playful, I suppose, but just as depraved.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all a fine line, and it is in the eye of the beholder. But I think Henry stands as just a quiet masterpiece. And as we've said, it's a very spare filmmaking, but really controlled. It's not like they went out on the street and did stuff. I don't know what the budget was or how much support he had, but it's a beautifully crafted movie.
I think he had like $100,000, like $100,000, 1980s dollars. Exactly. So not right. Still not much.
Yeah, well, maybe he had 250 in that regard, but you know,
that's still not a lot.
No, it's not a lot.
It still ain't much.
And
yeah, filmed in 28 days. And I think the thing that I think works really well for this film is the fact that John McNaughton, the director, was hired initially to direct, you know, some documentaries about gangsters in Chicago. So like we have that sort of documentary feel of this movie, like the Cinema Verde, you know, it's very it's of that ilk that it feels like a documentary, even though this isn't a documentary, although it is a little bit of a biopic in some sort of way. But like, I love that it kind of blurs that line. But the feel of the film, and I think the reason why it is so successful, is that it is coming from someone that, you know, directed documentaries. And so there is that sort of intimacy to it.
Also directed Wild Things.
Okay. I love that I found out last night that this is the director of Wild Things from the late 90s. Like that
Larry,
surprised
have you
the
seen
heck
Wild
out
Things?
Of me.
I'm not sure.
It's the one where Nev Campbell and Denise Richards make out in the pool.
Oh, well, I have seen it, but I wasn't going to tell you. No, I'm kidding. Oh, I've seen it. Oh, yes. Now, I'm not sure that I've seen it, but obviously I know the title. And I'm glad that he also made a De Niro movie with Bill Murray and De Niro, something weird. But it was sort of a mid-career thing. So he did carry on.
Yeah.
You see what it's called? It's called
Mad Dog Glory.
Yeah, Mad Dog and Glory. And that
from
was
1993, you know, yeah.
That was appealing. But I want to say one thing just because – In all due respect, you know, we're saying documentary, but what I thought was, you know, when you say documentary, it evokes like handheld fly on the wall, which is a great, obviously, approach. And we see that in movies from the 70s where you just feel like, oh, my God, this is unfolding in front of us and they're being captured. But what I also want to say is that I think what feels like a documentary is that there's nothing going on. There's no script that's like, you know, now but the filmmaking is extremely measured. Like those shots of the women that we've been describing, those are very elegant, very slow pan reveals. I mean, Kubrick would be proud, you know, so that's what's interesting. It's, I think he took his documentary sensibility to just tell it like it is versus to heighten it dramatically. He doesn't, he holds back from that. And he says, just observe with me. But like when she's telling, basically starting with it, my dad would ask me to show me his breast or my breast to, all right, I admit it. He was raping me to the point where I wondered if I was going to have a child with him. It's a slow push in. And then it's answered by a slow push in when Rooker reveals his dreadful parenting problems. So, you know, those are very elegant, clean choices, and that's what makes it I guess what I'm saying, sort of a mature movie. But yeah, of course, with this background and knowing the streets, there's some nice stuff like that.
I think that's a good clarification, because you're right, like this does not look like a documentary in terms of the filmmaking style. It is very elegant in that regard, as opposed to I think it's that eye, his eye to details and his sensibility of capturing things without embellishment is like, I think, what makes this such a gross movie to experience, for sure.
There's no safety in the artifice, you know, which of course we started by talking about my monster movie. Well, I literally lean in on the safety of like, it's a werewolf movie. So whatever truths I'm trying to get at, you have the safety of, and, you know, the pleasure of the genre element. But this movie gives you no cover.
None.
Yeah. So do we want to wrap this up and give it our rating out of 5?
Sounds good to me.
All right, Terry, you are up first. How many handsome young Michael Rookers out of 5 do you give?
I have a feeling I know what Terry's going to say.
He is so handsome in this movie. It was distracting. Like it's so funny to watch this movie because I love his performance in Slither. And so from my perspective with Michael Rooker, he is always Grant from James Gunn's Slither, because that was my introduction to him. And so to see him from like the 80s, just looking like has his hair and is looking really, really good in this movie, but then so horrible. Like it's great. But no, this is 5 out of 5 for me. I'm surprised when I looked at my letterbox from when I first saw it, I gave it a 3.5. And I don't know. This is really a masterpiece. It's not a movie that I want to revisit very often because it is such a grody film, and it is just, we talk about bleak on this podcast a lot, but this movie really is bleak just in the entire feel from the beginning to the end. It's just, there's nothing good happening in this film. It's a masterpiece. I can't say anything else. What about you, Mary Beth?
I'm going to have to agree with you because, again, always the letterboxed. When I first watched it, I was like, in my kind of, how do I put it? Learning to appreciate films like this because I hadn't been exposed to a lot of them. Like, I'd watched a lot of extreme horror and I loved extreme horror, but I'd never been exposed to something like this real feeling and like this deeply uncomfortable. And I had initially been like, I like it, but I don't know. It seems kind of exploitative. But then watching it now, I'm like, no, this is exactly how you do a movie like this. Like, I don't know how you could really do it any better. And I think that this is such an incredibly measured, like you keep saying, measured film that isn't trying to be about spectacle, but rather about reality. And yes, it's a movie. And yes, these are people playing characters, like actors playing characters. But I still think that there is something about this that feels so grounded and so very much trying to just show you that, like, this is the way of the world sometimes. And the way that our systems of capitalism and patriarchy have created people like this. And that's in this, and it, there isn't like, we're not trying to moralize, we're just showing. And I think we don't do a lot of that in cinema now. And it's really incredible to be able to have a piece of filmmaking like this. So it's 5 for me. Larry, you have the final word. How many young Michael Rookers out of 5 do you give this movie?
5 young Michael Rickers as well. I mean, I think it's a masterpiece of the genre. And I think you've been particularly articulate in saying the elephant in the room, which is like, yeah, there are a lot of bare breasts. It appears, I mean, these are the things that we might complain about in the media, you know, the male gaze and all that. I see none of it, though. I see a despairing, exactly, reality check. I keep saying it's rage cinema, which is to say, quietly saying, look at our society. It is brutal on the margins, and quite honestly, the women often are the ones that pay. But he's the most fetishized murder is of the goofy TV guy, they really torture him and gleefully put the, you know, plug the TV in now. Let's get an extra little bit of laughter out of it. So that's very, I don't think it corrects the fact, but I mean, Rooker seems to be going after women. And as I say, there's some real indication that his behavior and then Otis's in particular is motivated by not being able to express themselves sexually for reasons of their history. I keep referring to the little gay pass that Otis does to the kid. I mean, that's a bit of a shocker. And it's funny, even in the movie, it's a sting sound that you would save for a murder scene. He puts his hand on that kid's leg and it's literally a sound like, "Wah!" And you're like, oh boy. So, I mean, the filmmaker is saying, look, there's a lot of danger in these oppressed characters, and this is not, you know, so I'm giving you a clue as to maybe why people behave this way, but then I think he's also saying this is just a difficult world. And these people don't have maybe the money or the privilege, or in the case of Otis, even the intelligence to work their way out of it. I mean, that's another thing we haven't actually mentioned, but Rooker is obviously smart, and that's kind of disheartening because he's damaged and smart. And so he's going to keep doing this, whereas Otis basically fucks up because he's such a fucking jerk. So whatever. Anyway, I agree with you guys. It's I love the two perspectives. I'm so grateful that, to have this conversation about a real dreadful work of art. five Rookers. By the way, I did work with them. Are you guys aware? I made a movie called Hypothermia. I was the producer, and I spent a lot of time there up in the northern New York on a frozen ice lake. And he plays a very nice character. The film director was James McKinney. And I can tell you that, you know, what's interesting is Rooker, for one reason, he's in the movie because he was probably not at a high point in his career. Only after that, he got The Walking Dead and whatever he's done from there. But we caught him in sort of a vulnerable moment. He came up. He was very sweet. He plays a family man. Fighting a giant walking fish monster. So he was a fun guy to hang with. And the movie was produced by the same company that made Henry. So, you know, there was a through line for all of us in some way. And that's my Michael Rooker story.
That's amazing. Yeah.
That's so bad.
Man, I'll tell you later. I wish we had time to just like dig into your like film history, because I have so many questions, because you didn't talk about Until Dawn, writing for a video game, or even being in the video game. Like there's so much. I just I wish we had more time, but thank you. please. Yeah. But thank you again so much for joining us. Are you on social media, and where can our listeners find you if so? And the floor is yours to plug away.
So my company, and therefore all my handles, are Glass Eye Picks, PIX. Glass Eye Picks. And, you know, I'm old fashioned, so I sort of maintain the website, but we post on Insta, and I hate to say it, but X, whatever the fuck it's called. And, you know, I don't do TikTok. There's a way. I just have to draw the line. But, you know, I wish everyone well in their silly endeavors going down the rabbit hole and having their brains melting. You know, I really love movies, standalone movies, the 2-hour format, and I think Henry proves that it is still the most potent audiovisual experience. My own films are humble; they're about reality blending with the mythic. So my werewolf movie is called Blackout. Check it out. Tales from Beyond the Pale is also a fun way to enjoy my offerings, and many, many other horror filmmakers have participated. That's an audio broadcast. So talesfrombeyondthepale.com, I got to say, is a really fun way to take in some horror content. It's very varied because it's by different authors, a lot of great actors in there that will tickle your fancy, I think. And there's even a radio play of Blackout. So there you go.
Oh, hell yeah.
Amazing.
That's my pitch. GlassEyePicks.com and Insta GlassEyePicks and so on and so on. So that's awesome.
And listeners, we'll include all of that information in the show notes. So definitely go check it out.
Yeah.
All right, listeners. Well, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. What was your experience with Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer? You can let us know by sending us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on social media. I am at MB McAndrews on Twitter and at MB.McAndrews on Instagram.
And I'm a Gaily Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, follow the podcast on social media. At Scarred Podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky, and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you're listening to this before the 16th of April, please vote for us for a rondo, because that's amazing that we were nominated. So please go vote. Thank you.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there, but most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.